This is David Mankridge. We have four additional people to testify now. Bill Jones. Herbert Cooper.
Yes.
Roger Woods. Bill Reeve.
Bill Reeve, okay.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. I believe we're approaching now the time to start. I think at this time, Chairman, we're about to move our
Meeting will please come to order. Regular meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. Time is 4:08, February 26, 1986. Members present, Representative Navarre, Representative Kopanen, Representative Hanley, and Representative Collins is present in Anchorage. I'd like to welcome all the teleconference sites online. I'm not sure that we'll have enough time to take testimony from everyone, but we will do our best. Also like to welcome everyone visiting in Juneau, in various organizations and interests. At this time, we'll begin. The only bill we have up today is House Bill 494, an act relating to liens for labor and materials furnished, and the prime sponsor is Representative Sam Cotton, and we'll begin with him.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the committee taking time today to consider this bill. I know that you've been dealing with a lot more complicated subject than this for the last week, and we'll probably be spending a lot more time on that, so I think that you're going to find this a fairly easy issue to understand, although there is going to be volumes of material presented to you discussing the history and the workings or non-workings of the existing law. And because that's the reason I introduced the bill was because I had a lot of complaints from people who were primarily suppliers, contractors, and subcontractors who were having difficulty with the existing law. Many subcontractors weren't being paid, although the way I understand it, the actual laborers still enjoy a prime position when it comes to disbursements. And many suppliers have been donating materials to a lot of building sites at the, or at least that's the result, has been that they haven't been getting paid. Current law allows that in the event of a foreclosure, the lending institution's first deed of trust must be paid in its entirety before any other claims can be satisfied. The proposition being put forth in House Bill 494 is that others who had a claim on that property would enjoy equal position with the lending institution in the event of a foreclosure. And I think that obviously has raised a lot of concern from people who might end up in a different position as a result of this legislation. In addition to that, but that is the most important part of House Bill 494, that equal position. There are a couple of other things that are offered as suggestions that there have been criticisms of in the bill. I think there'll be some discussion about those later on. One of them includes a direct payment notice as opposed to a stop payment notice. A direct payment notice would allow the supplier or the subcontractor to file a direct payment notice to the lending institution, and if there was no objection, then the bank would, or the other lending institution would, pay that supplier or that subcontractor directly. And if there was an objection, then the institution would issue a two-party check, if you will, and then the two parties could fight it out themselves. In addition, there would be an extension of the notice from 15 to 30 days on the time allowed after a notice of completion. But again, these are smaller details that, again, I think you're going to hear a lot of discussion later. But I would just stop there in recognition of the time constraints here and be open to any questions now, and I plan to sit in on the committee meeting and be available for questions at any point. I know there's a lot of people from here out of town that would like to testify.
Thank you, Representative Cotton. We have several committee members who are not here today if you'd like to join us. I note the presence of Representative Mike Davis, and I know because of scheduling conflicts in order to get a teleconference, Representative Davis has a committee meeting right now, oil and gas.
That's correct. I postponed until 4:15.
Also, Representative Kopanen and Representative Hanley have a guest committee meeting beginning at 4:30, and will be here shortly, so apologize that the full committee will not be here, but the workload is mounting, and there will be some scheduling conflicts. Okay, and I'll announce the format that we'll attempt to use today, and that is that we're going to take testimony from those witnesses who are here today, who are from out of town, and everyone scheduled except for one is from out of town. And then we'll, as time permits, we'll go to the different teleconference sites and begin taking testimony. The bill will not move out of committee today, and so there will be an opportunity for those who don't get a chance to testify today to testify via teleconference at some later date. And I'd also like to let Representative Collins know that if she has any questions, just let us know and we'll accommodate you. At this time, we'll begin with Terry Turner.
Thank you, Chairman. I've prepared a summary of my testimony. If I could hand it to you and pass out to members of the committee, and we'll be handing out copies for everyone here.
You need to hand the microphone.
Attach the microphone?
No,
just flip up that switch.
Yeah. Thank you. May I begin? Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, well, my name is Terry Turner, and I'm an attorney for the Alaskans for Lien Law Reform, which basically are the prime sponsors of House Bill 494. We have given you a position statement which indicates a brief summary of some of the problems we think that exist with the present lien law and a suggested compromise that we think would meet some of the criticism of that bill. The committee has had numerous meetings with a banking association, the builders committees, and we're perfectly willing to compromise on our view. We think there's problems with the present lien law. We think compromises are necessary. House Bill 494 would solve our problems, but we think that if anything is to pass in this session, a compromise is necessary. Briefly, as I indicated, the suppliers and the subcontractors believe there's serious problems with the present lien law. The 1978-79 amendments to the law are not working. They're no longer a practical remedy for suppliers and subcontractors. The trust me attitude by the lenders in 1978-79 led suppliers and subcontractors to concede their superior lien priority to lenders in the mistaken belief the new stop payment remedy would offset the loss of their superior lien priority. The stop payment remedy is not working for a variety of reasons. For example, the shortness of the 30-day deadline by which a suit must be filed by the lien claimant, the bonding requirement, and the inability of most subcontractors to meet it, the lender's right to foreclose construction loans and wipe out the suppliers, subcontractors, and builders' liens after failing to responsibly and diligently monitor their loans. For example, I think lenders seldom condition construction loan disbursements upon receipt of lien releases from suppliers and subcontractors, which would be most helpful. All that the suppliers and the subcontractors want is parity, and I underscore that, parity with lenders, not a return to their former superior position. As I indicated, HB 494 would solve our particular problems, but it's met with stiff resistance from the builders as well as lenders. As a result, the suppliers and the subcontractors are willing to amend HB 494 to accommodate them, that is, the builders, but they don't believe that the lenders are seriously interested in a compromise at this point in time. Basically, the compromise that we would be willing to undertake would be as follows. We would abolish the stop payment provisions. We would drop our proposal for direct payment notices and joint payments. We would require the mandatory recording of notices of right to lien within a short period after supplies are furnished or work is first begun on a job. And we would drop the proposal to extend notice of completion deadlines. So in short, the cornerstones of the amendments proposed by the suppliers and subcontractors are as follows. Abolish acknowledgments of right to lien. As I indicated, instead require the timely mandatory recording of notices of right to lien. This eliminates the notice problems that plagued the title companies in 1978-1979. As Representative Cotton indicated, the biggest issue which you'll have to face is the question of equal priority. The suppliers and subcontractors believe that the liens of suppliers, subcontractors, and builders should be elevated to a level of equal priority with lenders, with appropriate accommodations to lenders to to meet their concerns. Among these priorities are lenders should still be able to summarily foreclose their deeds of trust out of court. They should be able
to
sell...
Excuse me, this is moderator in Anchorage, and we've lost transmission. It's breaking up quite a bit.
You're okay.
Lenders should be able to sell property purchased at their foreclosure sales free and clear of suppliers' liens by making appropriate bonding and escrowing requirements.
Okay, you may need to try to speak more into the microphone because it's
very well.
Yes,
try that again. As I indicated, lenders should still be able to summarily foreclose their deeds of trust out of court. Lenders should be able to sell the property purchased at their foreclosure sales free and clear of suppliers' liens by bonding or escrowing around them. And there should be a provision for joint ownership between the lender and valid lien claimants if the property cannot be sold at a reasonable price by the lender. In short, lenders and lien claimants should equitably share losses, and not the present system where suppliers and subcontractors share all of the losses. Other items that I think would be appropriate are requiring builders to apply construction loan proceeds to the authorized project with appropriate civil and criminal penalties if they don't. There's numerous concerns about builders taking construction loan proceeds, applying them to other jobs. I think that's a rare case, but I think even the builders would recommend that to help police their own organization. And finally, subcontractors and builders should be elevated to equal rank with suppliers for foreclosure proceeds sharing purposes. I think it's often forgotten that if the material men don't have enough money to satisfy them, the poor subcontractors are out under the present ranking arrangement. Briefly, that concludes my testimony. Speaking on behalf of Laskins for Lien Law Reform will be Don Abel of Don Abel Building Supply in Juneau, Sweet Holmstrom of United Building Supply in Anchorage, Jerry Harden of Ace Drywall, which is a subcontractor. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Is there any questions? Okay, the next witness will be Sweet Holmstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just briefly detail how this problem came about. I was one of the people who sat on the original committee in 1978 that drafted this law. And at that time, the material suppliers and subcontractors were asked to give up their historical priority position in the payment of their liens. We gave up that position in exchange for some promises that we would be paid out of construction financing, providing we provided certain notices to the lending institutions and to the owners of the property. Those two notices were a notice of right to lien and a stop payment notice. As it stands now, we can diligently record those, we can notify the lending institution, and we can notify the owner, and the notice of right to lien becomes completely disregarded, and we are not paid out of construction financing. Should the project go to foreclosure, the lending institution is in a first priority position, and they can completely extinguish our lien claims, and consequently we're just left holding the bag. In the disbursement of interim construction financing, the notice of right to lien was supposed to trigger the lending institution that there was a claimant out there who had a possible claim against that construction financing. He had provided materials, provided services for that job. However, that notice is being completely disregarded, and the payments in many instances are given directly to the contractor, to the borrower, who can use that money for any purpose, including leaving the state with a nice big nest egg, leaving the builders and the subcontractors and the building material suppliers just once again holding the bag. These were promises that were made by the lending institutions in 1978 when this law became effective. We were given the promise that our payments, our loan, or our notices of right to lien would be honored and that they would be taken care of out of construction financing. And those promises and the trust me attitude just has not worked. And I believe unless we get remedial legislation to overcome this difficulty, it's going to dramatically increase the price of construction materials. And it's a good deal like shoplifting. Somebody has to pay the price. And ultimately, the price is paid by the person who buys a new home. They're going to drive the cost of construction up, cost of building materials up, and the cost of home ownership is going to become much more expensive than it is now. That concludes my testimony, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Hanley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Holstrom, do you have any indication of how often the notice of right to lien and the stop payment notices are used by members of the group? Is this pretty much a routine kind of occurrence? Do the subcontractors and the supply companies automatically serve a lien, or is there a stop payment notice automatically given so that that construction loan can't be closed until those are satisfied?
Stop payment notice really has no value because the short time span, 30 days, isn't enough time. And then if a stop payment notice is given, we still have no priority, no claim on the money over and above the bank's claim. And traditionally, when a stop payment notice is given, the loan will stop, and the bank will draw down the interest and probably close the loan. And if we do have to enforce a stop payment notice, we have to provide a bond. And most small subcontractors cannot afford bonds in this present market. And the time span itself is too short to even attempt to do anything with a stop payment notice. To answer your question on the notices of right to lien, I believe almost all suppliers give notices of right to lien. We do almost 100%, and I am sure that several of the others do also.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next witness will be Don Abel. I want to give notice right here that if we can at all possible, and most of them already have been limiting their testimony, but probably to about 5 minutes, we have a lot of people on teleconference.
I understand, and I'll try to move along. I am Don Abel, and I'll try to reiterate as little as possible. I would like to give you two real quick examples when I finish with my testimony of exactly what I'm talking about. What we are is trying to establish some sort of parity. And we did give up in 78, and I worked on the committee, too, to the Gaber Superior Lien Law, which was considered by most of, in our field, as the best in the country at that time, and now we probably have one of the worst. It isn't working for us at all. You got to remember that the suppliers are divided. There were only a small portion of it. Even myself, and for instance, and I'm a full-range supplier, I might supply 15 to 18% of the total package. There's only one point of control that knows all the players and is dealing with a full deck of cards. Now, who the owner is, who the contractor is, how much money's involved, what the total construction package really is, and that's the lender. And you don't get to see that. We're just one player in the market. We have to have some way to get our fair shake out of the darn thing. It's often said, well, you know, you should know your contractor. You should know you have good credit policies. That can only work so far. In many cases, we have good contractors. We've known them for years. And most of their money comes from the borrowers. They don't have that money in pocket. They have to go get it somewhere. And a lender will own 80% of the job, roughly, at that point. So 20% theoretically comes from the contractor. What would happen, and I'd like to, at this case, give you two examples. Just happened to me here just a few months ago. I had one situation where a contractor who'd been dealt with this for about 8 years was building a fourplex. This contractor came in and wanted the finished package. We had already checked with the funding institution. Yes, there's a construction loan. Our experience with this man had been good. We sent out the finished package, and we didn't get paid in the 30 days. Another week went by. We checked. He said, "Something. I can't get any more money. They're not going to give me any money." We immediately sent a stop payment notice to the funding institution, went down and found out there is no more money. Loan's exhausted. But why? The job wasn't done. Well, we don't know. It was all drawn out about four or five weeks ago, and just wasn't aware of it. It was all taken out. I said, well, how can it be possible for this loan to be all dispersed and yet the job isn't done? Well, I don't know. What can we do? But nothing. We're going to foreclose. If you want it, go to the courthouse. Well, what then happened was that it was rented out. The lending institution did not require that any of that rent be applied against the loan. The contractor kept it and satisfied other debts at the time. It was foreclosed on, it was sold, and our $40,000 was the backup that the lender took to get their equity back out of it, all their fees, all their interest and everything. And they're a big part of the problem for not monitoring that loan. Second case just happened not too long ago. Another contractor we've been dealing with for about 4.5 years, built about 11, 12 houses through us, always been good. Suddenly middle of a job, two-thirds of the way through, and we said, you know, Jim, where is the money? He said, well, I don't know. He says, they're holding me up. He said, well, I'm sure it'll be straightened out in a week. A week went by. He said, they're not giving me any more money. The windows aren't even in it. So we set a stop payment. No, sorry, the funds are all gone. Wait a minute. Now, how can the funds be all gone when most of the suppliers aren't paid, even the dirt-moving people aren't paid in this job, and the funds are all gone? Well, that's just the way it is. We're going to foreclose. Well, they can sell that partly completed job and bail themselves out, but nobody else is going to get paid. Then I find out, getting the contract, I said, what happened? Well, first of all, he said I was a little behind in some other things, so they took $25,000 out of the construction loan and went other places. And he said there just wasn't enough to finish the job. That $25,000 would have finished the job. We'd all been paid, but it went somewhere else. This is the kind of thing we're faced with. We can't get in to find out what the mechanisms are going on, the manipulations. And before, and I don't say that was right, because the lending institutions had some advantage being taken of them under the old lien laws. And I think it was not good. I'm also sitting on a bank board, and I understand there were some situations there. We tried to even this thing out. It's gone too far the other way, and we need to come back. Bonding is, you bond the situation, you ever try to collect from a bonding company, it takes a long time, and it's usually a lawsuit involved. They very seldom pay off. You have to bring them in kicking and screaming. And I'm not talking about now by the fly-by-nighters or people that walk in that shouldn't have credit. I'm talking about people that are established, have a bona fide construction loan, and they're not being policed. And we're asked to bail out this kind of management. And we can't manage it. We cannot do it from just one small part of the segment. That's the conclusion of this. Want me to go on a minute more?
Are there any questions?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make sure I understood what the second example you gave. The contractor had drawn out that other $25,000 and used it in another place. Is that what happened?
He said, what he told me was the $25,000 at the beginning of the job was to be used for other, and the bankers knew that, to pay off other obligations. They then said, we will advance you money at the end to finish up the job if you give us additional security, which he did. He pledged another house. They kept the security and said, nope, no more money. So he was led on in that case.
So the lending institution was aware that the money was going to go for other than the
yes,
job.
That's what they told me.
It was originally intended for.
And in the first case, the contractor said the lending institution was aware that there wasn't enough money to finish the job because every segment had been going 10 to 15% over. And he also said he was indicated that there would be money enough to finish it up at the end of the project, which at the end of the project he couldn't get it, and I provide finish packages. It wasn't there. And
So your assurance would have been there if the parity would have been there.
Parity been there. We could
when, when the building was foreclosed, I just assume it would be an apportionment of pro rata apportionment.
Well, pro rata, or I think that the institutions, financial institutions, the lenders would be very interested in finding out what is against the job. Now they do not. Particularly, it used to be they always had lien releases. They were very interested in where the money was going. Now there hasn't been any interest at all, hardly, because they don't have to. You know, and I realize that's an extra imposition, but they're the only ones that know all of the players, or most of them. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm interested in the position of the owner, the poor guy that's trying to get the house built.
Well, that's an interesting.
What does he have? In fact, I remember prior to 78, Arlen Tusing, whom I knew personally, was building a house on Chena Ridge, and he ended up paying for it twice because of this kind of situation. And I had to assume that had been solved.
Well, the lien laws traditionally were put into effect because around the turn of the century, there was a lot of buildings being built, particularly in the Chicago area and other areas, where the contractor was paid to take a powder by the owner. And then nobody got paid. He was gone, and the owner got a building for a third of the price or very little. They were put into effect for a reason, and that's to protect the interest of the suppliers. Now, the owner, and in some cases, you're right. That's exactly what did happen. The contractors didn't pay, and the owners wound up paying. The theory at that point, or the point of law, was that the owner is supposed to know what's going on with his property. Now, you don't necessarily know who the owner is. Unless you have a title search made on every job, you might be dealing with a man, as we have, we thought was the owner, perpetrated as the owner, checked out well and found out the owner was not in him at all and was somebody else he was an agent for. And when we took the acknowledgement of right to lien, said we wouldn't sign that. Nobody will sign them. I mean, they're a useless piece of paper. So you can't make it, and the law presently doesn't require anybody to sign it.
Next witness will be Jerry Harden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My position to be here mainly is to speak on behalf of a subcontractor's side of the current lien law. I'll try not to be repetitive. I know from experience the last 2 years the lien law is not working for my company and many subcontractors that I know of. We talk about the issue of parity, and that's exactly what a subcontractor wants. He wants equity. I don't know how much SBS or United or some of the supplier companies can handle as far as losses, but I know that the subcontractor, he can't handle very many losses. And at least in the city of Anchorage, and I know Wasilla, where I'm from, the subcontractors are going down in mass numbers because of the fact that they have no equity position whatsoever. They have very limited ability to check credit ability for a home builder. If a subcontractor tries to meddle in that kind of business, he subjects himself to possibly losing jobs, and the banks are, mum is the word, because of the Privacy Act. They can't say much about a builder. So subcontractors in a very bad position. I've told this I've been in most of the meetings with the bankers and suppliers, and the bankers do not build the building. The suppliers don't even build the building. The ones that are really getting hurt in this issue are the tile layers, the sheetrock hangers, the carpet layers, the people that are physically building the structure. Those are the ones that end up with zero. I'm not saying that the suppliers are not losing money and the bankers are not losing money in cases of foreclosure. For every banker and for every supplier, there's probably 10 or 15 subcontractors, and for every builder, there's 10 subcontractors that have no equity position and that are in the same boat as I am. My company lost, I'll tell you the figure, $187,000 over the last 2 years. And the only reason that I'm in existence is because I put everything that I've ever made in my company back in my company, and I'm still here. But I had a substantial loss, and I want to say this before everybody, that I followed the lien law to the T and ended up with zero. And that's a problem. And it's a problem with a lot of people you'll hear on testimony of subcontractors that will testify of the very same thing that I'm saying. There are a lot of issues that I think that can be resolved as far as equity position. And it's my feeling that that equity position would help funds to be monitored up front, not later. I don't want these things to go to foreclosure and then have to be in equity position with a bank. That's not what I'm looking for. I'm not looking for to have the builders, to have the banks babysit the builders and do everything for them. I think they need to have a free hand. But I believe that somewhere in the middle ground, the financing institutions need to monitor their loans to the extent that people that are physically doing the work get paid. And basically that's where I'm from, and that's probably the extent of my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Harden. Are there any questions?
Just real quickly, and maybe you're not the right person to ask, but as I was giving my opening remarks, I allowed that I thought that the actual person doing the labor was still able to recover at least his wages in a foreclosure situation. But the subcontractor, you, the businessman, are not. Is that the way that works?
That's correct. I'm not sure where the physical, actual, most even contractors, at least in Anchorage that I know of, physically do the work themselves, and they're a contractor. And if they're a contractor, licensed and bonded with the state of Alaska, they're in the same boat as me. I don't physically do any work, hang sheetrock, but if a tile setter owns his own company and he sets a tile, he's in the same boat as I am. And I would say that's a large percentage of the manpower work done in Anchorage is done that way.
Note for the record the presence of Representative Drew Pierce. Also note the presence of Representative Randy Phillips. Next witness will be Sam Hill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. I represent the Building Industry Association of Anchorage, which is the local chapter of the Home Builders Association. The Alaska State Home Builders Association is holding a meeting here also, and I'm speaking and presenting a position that represents the six local associations' views plus the State Home Builders Association's views. After reviewing House Bill 494 and giving serious consideration to the merits of the bill, the Board of Directors of the Building Industry Association of Anchorage and the State Alaska State Home Builders Association cannot at this time support the measure in its present language. We are understanding of certain problems that have occurred in past years regarding foreclosure of properties and the consequent non-satisfaction of claimants' rights against that property. However, House Bill 494 does not satisfy that situation. We believe that there are avenues of recourse under the present Alaska lien law that, with modification of various areas, can adequately substantiate supplier and subcontractor interest in a construction project. One example that will assist in this is the elimination of the acknowledgement of right to lien. We also favor mandatory notices of rights to lien on all properties and projects. An additional possible alternative to this problem is the institution of some type of criminal penalty against a misappropriation of funds by a borrower. This constitutes embezzlement, fraud, or other felony offenses in many states throughout the country. By instituting some type of action in this manner, we believe the responsibility of timely and correct payment to rightful claimants can become an enforceable issue mandated by the courts with appropriate penalties for those who do not comply. We believe this satisfies the concerns of the suppliers and subcontractor without depriving the builders of their control and managerial rights. We also believe it additionally maintains the bank's priority position on construction loan. This would also include criminal penalties for filing of false liens as protection to the general contractor. The very cornerstone of our profession rests with our ability to manage and control our funding. We acknowledge that problems exist within all facets of the industry, to include lending institutions, suppliers, and subcontractors. We also believe those problems are compounded because of recessive market conditions. As such, we firmly believe the existing problems are self-correcting and will return to acceptable standards given time. I want to just bring up a couple side points. What we've been hearing is the illusion that every builder in the room goes to foreclosure. Every project that we get into goes to foreclosure. We've also heard the illusion that every bank that loans construction money does not police that loan. Gentlemen, that's not the real world. The foreclosure issue has taken precedence in this whole thing and has put what we think an undue light on a problem that does not exist to the degree of the foreclosure issue. Properties are not going to foreclosure in the rate that's being alluded to. We're seeing recessive market conditions. We're seeing a market that the entire state was used to, a very active market. We're seeing that decline. I think that we're seeing a realignment of the ways the bank loaned money. I think we're seeing a realignment of the ways that suppliers and subcontractors issue their credit policies. I think that the idea that this is a simple issue and can be solved by easily is a falsity. We need to understand that this is very complex. There are serious complications involved, and I'm sure the Alaska Bankers Association is going to talk about some of the problems involved with outside participation of lending, which is a major problem if this bill should go through. It has major effects on the way that we as builders borrow money. It has major effects on the cost of doing business, on what we pay for our money, and the administration of our monies. And we just want to go on record at this time as adamantly against House Bill 494. We do acknowledge and we do support the abolishment of acknowledgments of rights to lien as was brought out by the coalition. We think that's a step in the right direction. But we also think that time is a correcting on this thing, and that general lending policies are going to change, and that supplier and subcontractor credit policies are going to change. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I at least wasn't under the impression that all banks were not scrutinizing their loans or any other thing. I just was under the impression that there are problems. And the other thing I think I should state is that I don't think I've found an easy issue yet in the legislative process.
Yeah, Sam, I appreciate your remarks there, and I also appreciate the association being clear about their position. Sometimes people aren't certain as to what the position being taken is, and I think you made it real clear that you do not want to change the first priority position with the banks. And I'm anxious to learn more about the effects of that outside money might be as well. I don't pretend to know as much as bankers might about that. But I think that there is a problem, and as the chairman pointed out, by presenting examples, I don't think I was led to believe that each home builder had a problem or that a large percentage of homes are being foreclosed on. But I am aware that several have, and that subcontractors have been doing work without getting paid, and suppliers have been putting materials on jobs and not getting paid for it. And I appreciate the fact that you've offered some suggestions, but it's still my feeling that if there was some equity as far as who had which rights at the time of foreclosure, a lot of these other problems would solve themselves. And I'm waiting to be convinced otherwise, I guess. Your suggestion of criminal penalties I'd be real happy to take a closer look at that.
If I might expand on that and just for briefly, we think the industry and the contracting industry should be self-policing itself. There's 22 states in the union that institute criminal penalties for misappropriation of construction funding. If that's what it takes to get the example across, then I think that that's the direction that we should head. And again, it's self-policing in the industry itself. And that is the basis for our instituting the criminal actions against the misappropriation of construction funding.
I appreciate your constructive attitude.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll look forward to working with and hearing from you as to your suggestions as we go through this bill. Next witness will be Mark Passy.
Thank you, Chairman. Again, here representing the State Home Builders Association also. And again, I would like to reiterate most of the points that Sam made. We do acknowledge there is a problem with the current lien laws. And again, we don't feel that House Bill 494 is the answer. And Representative Hanley asked earlier if she thought if the current lien laws were used. It is definitely our feeling that the current lien laws are not used to the full extent that they should be. One of the biggest problems has been the acknowledgement of right to lien, which both parties on the conflicting sides of this have acknowledged they'd like to see done away with. That's because there's nothing that says the owner of the property has to sign that acknowledgement to lien, and without that, there is no lien. And then the current lien law is just too complex to be followed to the letter of the law, and so that it again does not get used to the extent that it does. We feel that using the right to lien form at the very beginning, when a subcontractor or supplier supplies labor to the job, then that goes to the title company, gets recorded, that automatically puts the title company in notice and the bank that there is a lien there, and then that would abolish the problems that arise. And putting a criminal offense on it will take that contractor that takes his loan, runs off and buys his sailboat or buys something else with the money and does not pay his bills, will make him responsible for his bills, other than right now he doesn't even get a slap on the hand, and it is the subcontractors and the suppliers that do get hurt. So again, we back most of the proposals that the suppliers did acknowledge. It has come a long way in the last couple, 3 weeks when the proposal first came out, but again, we believe that the control cannot be taken away from the builders, that we have to be able to run our companies, manage them, and not the bank or the suppliers. Thank you.
Thank you. I guess I should also acknowledge that we have received probably 400-1 in favor of the bill correspondence, and that may be a reflection of just the fact that there are problems out there, not that the bill is the eventual solution to that.
Well, I think the Alaskans for lien law reform have been doing a pretty active lobbying effort.
I would agree with that.
I became first aware of this problem back in July. That was the earliest indication. And when I'm saying aware, Representative Cotton and I have gotten the same complaints from our own constituency on this issue. Now, these people here from the, I almost said tort reform, but the coalition here just happened to be, their timing was good. So it's a problem that we picked up in our own district, and it frankly needs to be addressed or at least looked at to solve these problems. I don't believe, in my mind, that this is manufactured by this coalition. They happen to be around here, they recognize a problem, and they identify it, and it's brought to our attention that this group was around. And I'm just saying that we were notified long before this coalition was even put together.
There is no problem, but there is a problem. We all acknowledge the problem. At the moment, we just don't feel the writing of 494 is the exact answer.
Agreed. I mean, I agree, but the bill does bring the attention of all parties involved to discuss these things and try to find a solution.
Definitely.
And that's the reason for the bill.
It's also the reason for committee meetings.
Right.
Right in that. Next witness will be Dick Enberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen. The subject of mechanics lien law is at best an extremely complicated subject. It is not something that can be easily reduced to very simple language. It is with this in mind that I'd like to make a few comments regarding the Alaska Bankers Association's views on the matter. The fundamental question posed by House Bill 494 is one of policy. Shall a mechanics lien laws be returned to what did not work and will not work? Prior to 1978 and 79's amendments, Alaskan law had the effect of compelling construction lenders to superintend their borrowers. And it is the borrower's contractors, the contractor's subcontractors, and payment of all costs of them incurred for labor and materials in the course of a construction project. The law did not accomplish that result by imposing a direct obligation on the lender to do so. It achieved the result rather by assigning priorities that placed the lender's security at risk if it failed to superintend, in effect to make itself all payments. That law did not work. Title to properties was rendered so uncertain that title insurance became unavailable. Thus, the sale or refinancing of the project to which construction lenders look for payment of the construction loans could not go forward. Precisely because the law did not work, it was amended. The amendment substantially shifted the burden of policing payment for labor and materials from the lender to persons who are themselves furnishing labor and material. It did so by subordinating most mechanics' liens to the prior recorded lien of the construction lender. While it can be drafted more artfully, the present statute accomplishes that fundamental policy change, that trade creditors, rather than lenders, should bear the primary burden of getting themselves the trade creditors paid, and without leaving the trade creditors unprotected. It is, of course, in the nature of the 1978 and 79 amendments, and the very purpose of those amendments, that trade creditors have less protection than they enjoy under the prior law. But the remedies they currently have are nonetheless substantial. A tradesman has a lien that survives any transfer of an interest in a property other than a sale and foreclosure of a prior recorded lien. His lien, consequently, is superior to the interest of any purchaser except that of a purchaser through foreclosure. A tradesman lien can, it is true, be foreclosed by a construction lender, a consequence of the essence to the solution of the problems that arose under prior. The mechanic lien, the unpaid tradesman, is accorded the ability to put the construction lender to a very hard choice, either to cease construction lending or proceed at the risk of incurring dollar for dollar liability to the tradesman. It is our belief that the existing law is currently not being properly used by suppliers and subcontractors. The very fact that lenders receive very few stop payment orders would seem to confirm this belief. Our question then is, shall the policy decisions embodied in the 1978 and 79 amendments be reversed? Shall the law be returned to what did not and will not work? Enactment of House Bill 494 will surely accomplish a return to unworkable law. I'd like to make just two additional comments here with regards to the parity question. The Bankers Association does not believe that this will be a workable solution. We have just received, as well as you, the proposed solution with regards to foreclosure of equal priority among lenders and subcontractors and suppliers. we believe that if that is adopted, there will be substantial litigation as a result of that passage. Secondly, I'd like to address this question of stop payment. In addition to being the representative of the Alaska Bankers Association, I'm also a senior vice president of the First National Bank of Anchorage. In the normal course of our business, we provide a substantial amount of construction loans for purchases for the construction of residential units. In the last 5 years, to the best of my knowledge, our bank has been served with 3 stop payment notices. We acknowledge that we receive notices of right to lien, and in those instances, we respond. We also respond with respect to the stop payment orders when we receive them. It is not simply a decision that when we receive one, we automatically initiate foreclosure. Mr. Holmstrom inferred that banks, upon receipt of a stop payment order, continue to accrue their interest, charge the loan for the interest, etc. That simply is not true, and if they do that, then Mr. Holmstrom has a valid claim against the lender for the amount of any undisbursed funds at the time he provides them with a stop payment notice. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Cotton?
Again, I'm looking forward to being educated on some of the problems that banks face. One thing I was curious about was some statistics on how often or how many foreclosures your bank has seen, or perhaps the banking industry has seen. Are there some statistics on that are available?
Those statistics are not readily available, Mr. Cotton. However, I can tell you what our experience has been in the last 5 years. We have had one foreclosure of a construction loan, and on that foreclosure, all subcontractors, suppliers, material, et cetera, had been paid prior to the foreclosure by the owner of the property.
What period of time was this now?
Excuse me?
What period of time is this?
Over the last 5 years.
So would the switch from existing law to the proposed law as far as who's got what position, it doesn't sound like it would affect your bank at all then, is that correct?
Well, very definitely would. It would enter and incur decisions upon, or infer that we have to make some decisions on whether to lend the money or not, subject to a situation that we may face further on down the line, and that being parity with lien claimants.
But from your experience, it sounds as though it wouldn't have affected you at all in the last 5 years.
I think it would have affected some of our decisions on projects that we did finance, yes.
But as far as which ones went to foreclosure and who got paid anyway, I didn't know the answer to that question, and I was surprised to hear that he only foreclosed on one and the subcontractors got paid anyway.
Well, we're a conservative bank.
So my conclusion was, maybe you're not agreeing with it, my conclusion was that it wouldn't have made any difference which law was in effect as far as your bank was concerned, as far as the outcome.
Well, I don't think that conclusion can be made.
The other question I had was on, you mentioned some litigation that might come up, and I wasn't sure whether you meant that you might expect some litigation as far as a challenge to the constitutionality of the bill, or would there be increased litigation at some other place?
I believe the litigation, I can't answer to the constitutionality question, but I firmly believe that there would be severe legal problems and litigation that would ensue with regards to the parity issue at a foreclosure. And our next testimony we'll hear is from the Bank Association's legal counsel on that. You might ask them.
One thing that you may want to dwell on, and something that I think is a major point that's been raised here, is one of the statements you made that you felt that the remedies available to suppliers, subcontractors, etc. now are substantial. And those people are coming to us and saying they're not substantial, they don't work. So I think that there's going to have to be attention focused on that point. Are those remedies substantial? Do they work? And apparently, people that are using them suggest they do not.
We suggest they do not use them. And that when they do use them, they're not familiar with the procedures that they have to use. I have numerous occasions in dealing with subcontractors on a commercial lending side, asked them why they do not file a notice of stop payment. And many times the answer is, well, if I do that, I won't get any more work from the guy. And my advice is to him, forget that, go get your $30,000 and file your notice of stop payment. So there are a lot of ramifications that come from those subcontractors out there in that regard.
Sounds like I've got something else to learn on that, because the next, I want to ask that same question to some of the people that are on the other side of this issue.
I think that the fact that we only received 3 stop payment notices over a 5-year period should say something.
I think it was mentioned earlier that the stop payments really don't work or aren't effective.
We contend that they are effective. They simply are just not used and followed through.
Thank you. Next witness will be John Beard.
I'm a lawyer, and I'm from Anchorage, so I guess I've got 2 strikes against me right now. I'm also here at the request of the Bankers Association.
That's 3.
They've asked me to look at the bill, and without going into detail, I would like to make a couple of observations to the committee. The lien law is, as it is now, as it might be changed, it's a pretty complicated piece of legislation. It's a balancing act. We're dealing, it's the nature of things, with a number of people who have extended credit on the security of a single piece of property. And the lien law is the legislative attempt to adjudicate when things go wrong, who gets first resort to the property, who gets second resort to the property, and that sort of thing. When an effort is made to amend some part of the law, it's got to be done with an eye toward how that amendment is going to relate or integrate with other provisions of the present law. That simply has got to be done, and I don't see it being done in the bill that's before the committee.
I just want to interrupt. That's why we have these committee meetings. That's why we're going through this process.
And that
the eventual vehicle will relate to the other.
Sure, and that's my initial comment. There is in the bill the idea that the priority of the various claims against the piece of property going to be changed. That much is clear. Suppliers and contractors are going to be given the same priority as a lender. Now, the lenders, for reasons perhaps of basic policy, object to that, but for purposes of the mechanics, that in and of itself is internally inconsistent with a separate provision in the lien statute that ranks the very lien claimants themselves, doesn't treat them equally, and that problem isn't fixed. I notice in the Alaskan for Reform proposal now, they are suggesting that there might be modifications that ought to be made here. I think that's right, but I don't know myself how they might be accomplished, what they might be. The law that, or the bill that would give equality to all of these folks does not, as now the proponents of the bill are suggesting it ought, even indicate that there can be a mechanism to get the land back on the market, this half-finished piece of construction, and the property is sitting, by definition, it's fallen apart, it's probably not completed, it's an at-risk position, and the present bill, it seems to me, simply invites that property sitting stale for a long period of time while folks are litigating and getting through the process of foreclosure in the courts. Now the proponents are suggesting, well, let's take advantage of the lender's ability to get the property sold in a quicker fashion, summarily, and that would seem like a good step towards solving that problem. But what then is to be done in terms of, and what they have in mind in terms of bonding or escorting around other liens, that I just don't understand what that proposal would be or how that would be accomplished. The second point I'd like to make, my principal point being this is a complex piece of legislation we're amending, and that the amendment that's proposed, the principal amendment on the subject of priorities, has got to be integrated with the rest of the law, with the rest of other real property law that we've got. Second point I'd like to make is to echo, I think, Mr. Enberg's observation that there hasn't been much understanding, perhaps, but in any event, attempt on the part of claimants to use what remedies they've got. I believe Mr. Holstrom, after he said that lenders were inclined to disregard these stop payment notices, also said that at least his firm wasn't using the mechanism at all. Well, if a lender disregards a stop payment notice, he is liable to the extent he does it to the claimant. That gives a claim, and yet it's apparently not being used. I don't, by any manner of means, want to make snap judgments, but the two illustrations that Mr. Abel gave of where he was having problems both suggest to me, and of course he was brief with his facts, that he probably did have a claim against the lender. Once again, he might well have been protected under the law. Don't know what he did to follow up on it. I believe that's all I'd want to advise the committee at this point. Certainly, if there were some further draft of a bill, it would be something to look at, to react to. But right now, we've only got this one in front of us.
Okay. Well, the way that I have kind of the way I understand the testimony so far is that some of the suppliers and subcontractors and others feel that there's a problem in that. If it reaches a critical stage where it goes to foreclosure or whatever else, then the bank is going to get their money, and they're going to do whatever is in their best interest to get the money that's due them. And they don't, the subcontractors who may or may not know that it's to a critical point, have no access at that point.
Well, I don't know, first of all, that it is the case. In fact, I represent banks, and I know a lot of circumstances. It's the case. The lender right now has the first lien. That does not mean the lender gets its money. It simply doesn't mean that. It frequently means the lender also is going to lose money.
Right.
It does, however, have the ability to foreclose the inferior claims. We're looking at a loss situation.
The first lien, if there's a loss, say it's a $100,000 loan, up getting $50,000 back, okay, as a first lien holder, you get the $50,000, right? I mean, if there's other claims, you get yours, and whoever else has to find some other means to get theirs.
Right? Well, but in that circumstance, of course, the lender lost $50,000. Now, how many other claims were there out there that lost?
Right, that's what I'm saying. Everybody loses. It's just that everybody else loses 100%,
yeah,
and you only lose 50%.
Well, $50,000, if the other claims are $30,000, the lender's taking the bigger beating, it seems to me.
Yeah, but the lender should also be, I mean, they're the ones who are lending the money, and granted, I haven't met very many lenders in my life who are liberals. so I think that they do scrutinize to a pretty extensive degree. However, sometimes the amount of money that a subcontractor or a supplier loses to them may be a great deal of money.
Oh, that could be. Everybody's dealing with the same person. Everybody's dealing with the contractor or whoever happens to be the borrower. That's who the bank's dealing with. That's who the sub's dealing with. That very frequently is who the materialman is dealing with. And if that is a weak chain, a weak link in the chain, people are going to get hurt. That's true. And the unhappy circumstance is nobody seems to know he's weak until he's broken. And there are losses, and there's sorting out that's got to be done.
And the other thing is, the first lien holder, if there's a $100,000 loan or whatever, and your amount is $80,000 of that, you get 80% of your money back, and they still lose 100% of theirs.
Well, yeah, by definition. They lose their security. We're talking about security. We're not talking about, though it frequently is going to be the same thing, we're not talking about loss of a claim against whoever the defaulting debtor is. The suppliers and the subcontractors still have their debt claims against that person. We are talking about security that by definition is worth less than the total of the claims against it.
It all equates down to money, right? And the dollar. Representative Pierce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When banks make loans to construction loans, they usually, I understand, only make a loan of a percentage of the final worth of the project. What is the standard?
I really can't speak to that, Representative. I think maybe there might be some other witnesses from the lending industry who might be able to answer the question. I'm not a banker, so I can't tell you the answer to that question.
I didn't catch your name.
John Beard.
John, your comments seem to be directed at the fact that this was a very complicated subject and that this law ought to be integrated with the rest of our statutes. I didn't really understand what you were getting at there. Obviously, it's a complicated subject, but did we overlook something as far as the way the bill's drafted now? Did we miss an area of law that should have been considered?
Yes, indeed.
You don't need to do that now, but could you provide us something in writing on that so that we could be aware of that?
Sure.
We pay good money for half a dozen or a dozen lawyers down the street here to write this stuff for us, and so it sounds like...
I'm not necessarily saying that I can't recall that there is language in the bill that I think is offensive or inartful. I think that there are other aspects of the law that are just overlooked that are going to be greatly affected by what you're doing with this bill.
Can you give us some particulars on that?
Yes, I can. As an example, this bill makes all lien claimants of equal priority, whereas I think it's 112, section 112 of the lien statute, says they are not equal among themselves. The priority among lien claimants is, I believe it's subcontractor, materialman, subcontractor, prime contractor. This bill would make them all equal with a lender. So there's just one illustration of something that's been overlooked.
If you have others, I should appreciate your point.
I certainly will.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Beard. Next witness is Greg Jones. Chair, used to work with him. Hi, Greg.
Representative of our members of the committee. My name is Greg Jones. I'm a real estate developer. I guess sometimes the weak link that was just talked about. I'm affected by the bill, both directly through the fact that when I develop a subdivision, I'm in the position of the builder. Indirectly through the builders that I'm marketing lots to and their position with their banks. I'm speaking on behalf of myself because I'm concerned about concerned that the basic premise of the bill may not solve the problems that have been described, and in fact may make them worse. The bill appears to be a reaction to a slowdown in the market and is not based on a historic adverse relationship between business volume and business losses, and I think that's what we're talking about, is business losses. There is less business volume right now affecting the people who are proponents of the bill, and the fact that there's less volume, there is more people are suffering, but I don't think that that's a result of the lien laws that exist today. I think it's an economic fact. There are some procedural adjustments that need to be made to the bill. I'm not a banker, and I'm not a supplier, and so I'm not going to propose to tell you what those adjustments should be, but I can hear it very clearly that they need to be made. Representative Cotton pointed out at the outset that the real issue is the position of the bank, and I think he's correct. And I think you as the decision makers have to discuss the practical impact of that. By degrading the position of the bank with respect to their loan funds, they're subjected to greater risk. Consider that the decision to go forward with a project is made by really jointly between the bank and the builder or developer. The risk that those two entities assume with their cash and with the personal guarantees are really 90% of the risk that goes into any project. The subcontractors and suppliers should be protected and their protection should be based on the proportion of the risk that they take. The equitable method of prioritizing the lien positions, I really think, is embodied in the parity that's or in the position that the liens are left in the current bill. Specific concerns that I have: when the position of the lending institution is diminished, they will make fewer loans, and then only to the strongest borrowers. The building industry in Alaska is unique in the United States. I just attended the Home Builders Association convention in Dallas. There were 70,000 people there. It's very clear that Anchorage, that Alaska, that the entire building industry in this state is very different from the rest of the United States. And I think we're trying to apply an outside solution to an Alaska problem. The backbone of our building industry are the small builders. I have a large real estate project that I'm overseeing in Anchorage right now. And the builders that are building there, by national standards, would be very tiny. Those are the builders that will be hurt by this law because the bankers won't consider them strong enough to take the risk, the increased risk that the law throws onto them. The outside lenders that have been referred to also affect me directly because of the lending limits in this state, we have to have outside participants in our projects. The builders are in the same position. If they feel that they're at greater risk and they have to rely on a local Alaska bank to protect themselves, they're going to elect not to participate in the market up here if they feel like that it's just, if the risk is too great. If we don't have that participation, if we don't have the small builders, then the market slowdown that we're looking at right now will be exacerbated, and in fact the suppliers will be hurt by this bill and not saved. The end result is the economic momentum slows down, and everybody is hurt. I would urge you not to tamper with the priority of the liens within the lien law. Work with the suppliers and work with the lending institutions to tighten the procedures. And I think you've heard the testimony you've heard today. Many of the problems are very directly related to the procedure of how people are notified. Everybody's trying to cut their losses. That's what this bill is intended to do. And I can't even remember who said it, but the point was made that you don't know that there's going to be losses until all of a sudden they're staring you in the face. Take a positive step to try to tighten the procedure so you know those losses are coming, and that can be done. The lending institutions, if they know the losses are coming early through whatever procedures we can work out, are going to save everybody money by cutting the losses early. Make it a positive step, and I think the way it's written right now, it will definitely end up being a negative step. I'll be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Great. I don't want to repeat something you said, but let me tell you what I thought I heard you say, and then you tell me if you said it and what you meant by it. You should base a person's ability to collect on the amount of risk that they put forward. In other words, the supplier takes a certain risk, the subcontractor takes a certain risk, the bank takes a certain risk. And I thought one of your opening remarks allowed that there should be some comparison of a person's ability to collect based on the amount of his risk.
Well, each person who is owed anything should have an absolute ability to collect, and I'm not saying that some people should have less of a right to what is owed to them. I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm saying that the risk should be shared equitably, not with a across the board parity, and equality is what I'm looking at. You know, if you put up for financing the project, if you put up $10 and a supplier puts up $1, then there should be equity in the position in collecting those dollars.
In other words, if the bank put up 90 cents and the supplier put up a dime, and the foreclosure only netted 50 cents, then are you saying that the banker should be able to get 90% and the supplier 10% of that 50 cents, 45 cents in the nickel?
I don't think that. No, that's not what I'm. That's not what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say is that the lead position in any, when you get to that small percentage, and I think that's important also. That small percentage where you have a foreclosure, and you're having to cut losses, which is what the bill is designed to do. That the lead position ought to be taken by those with the greatest risk, not to the absolute detriment of everyone else involved. And I think that can be solved with procedures. make those with the greatest vested interest, those who do their best to cut the losses. If you can procedurally make sure everybody knows this is occurring sooner, then you'll cut the losses for everyone.
Yeah, I think, you know, there again, that's the goal that I have in giving those persons an absolute ability to collect on an equitable basis. And perhaps we can design procedures. I haven't seen any specific suggestions that appear to accomplish that, but I know that as a, are you still a commissioner?
Yes.
I know that as a as a judge, and every Monday night you have to find those answers sometimes. So I invite and welcome your suggestions on procedures that could be adopted.
I appreciate that. I feel a little inadequate to do that now, but I'll be glad to continue to work on it.
Representative Phillips, I wanted to interject. Yes, Greg, what is your definition of the greatest risk?
Well, the definition of the greatest risk, I guess in the simplest terms, it can be expressed in numerical amounts.
Let me give an example of what I was saying. Okay, let's use the 90-10, 90 cents, the bank puts up 10 cents, the builder puts up. Well, that 10 cents of the builder may be everything he has. Well, the 90% might be 1% of the total value of the bank, or whatever money they have in the, I'm going to speak facetiously, in the vault.
I understand.
So, that's what I was thinking of the greatest risk.
I understand that definition of risk. I don't agree with it philosophically, but I still think that the guy that is owed the 10 cents is going to be in a better position if he has early knowledge and if he is working with the guy with the greatest risk, who's owed 90 cents, to cut the losses. And I think that we can do that and give the lending institution, those people that have stepped forward and put up the cash and taken the risk, give them the ability and in fact hold them to some methods, some procedures for monitoring the loans, give them the ability to cut those losses early. I don't think we can design legislation that fits the individual business relationships that people have with their businesses. I mean, you can compare the guy that has, the little guy that where a dime is a lot, you can compare that to Spenard Builder Supply, where, they're in pretty much the position of the bank in terms of the size of the losses.
Thank you very much. Next witness will be Wes Club.
No, who?
My name is Wes Club. I am a senior vice president of Alaska Mutual Bank, located in Tulane, Anchorage, Alaska. Actually, I came up here to say all kinds of things, and I do want to say that in the business of construction lending, which I primarily am responsible for as Alaska Mutual Bank's concern, Alaska Mutual is the primary or the largest construction lender in the state of Alaska. In the last 5 years, it appears that in the 16 areas that have building permits, over 40,000 houses were built. It's amazing they got built with all the problems that we have, and it's amazing everybody's lost so much money. I think statements have been made relative to contraction economic conditions. They play a role in it. I can assure you not only suppliers and subcontractors have gone out of business, I can assure you that builders have gone out of business, as have grocery store owners and jewelry store owners and everybody else. You're not going to absolutely legislate some guarantee that people are going to be paid in any way, shape, or form. You're not going to do it. The way these people go at this thing, they want us to write absolutely each check, each invoice to them from the bank side. If we do that, it will change substantially, given this something called parity. I do not know how you're going to get there. It will change substantially the manner in which we do business as an institution. That's a guarantee from that standpoint. The opposition tells me it's threats. It's not threat. It's business measuring risks, measuring where we stand, and so forth and so on. In the last 5 years, I would say this bank has built in excess of 8,000 houses using housing units. We have had foreclosures. Some foreclosures, we did foreclose the interests of some people. it doesn't mean that we foreclosed the entire interest, because the way it makes it, everybody's making it sound is they were never received partial payments, whatever. It's a very complex, the whole thing is a complex issue as it relates to risk and risk management, how we allocate dollars to what we do and why we do it. It has ramifications to not only houses, it has to do with land development, it has to do with major office buildings, and right on down the line. It does not just apply to one house. And it gets very complex as it relates to multi-unit projects, apartment houses, and a variety of other things. Everybody makes it sound like, you know, at the big bank, we can lose, and we lose. And it's, I can guarantee you, in the 50-plus foreclosures we've had in the last 5 years, we have not made money on one foreclosure. In fact, the opposite is true. Principal losses, not interest losses, principal losses in every foreclosure that we've done. Typically, the reason for foreclosure is the failure of the property itself to be marketable. That is typically the major source of foreclosure. That basically, and well, one of the last mutual definitely opposes 494. I'm willing to answer any questions that you may have.
Would you admit that there is a problem with the lien laws, or any suggestions for...
My opinion as it relates to the lien laws, I think it is poorly used at this point in time by the people that should be using it. There was comments as it relates to stop payment orders that are not are ignored. That is absolutely incorrect. Mr. Beard testified that if we ignore him as a lender, and we have absolute liability in that regard. Typically, what happens, and from the standpoint, a notice of a problem, is that we are notified in many cases 100 days, 110 days after a bill is due. Not 30 days, not 45 days, not 50 days, in many cases 100 days. We cannot help in the individual case, and it doesn't happen often. I can assure you, basically, in our volume of business, and we have excellent builders and so forth and so on, and some of which are here. They could stand up here and tell you, I've done $11 million worth of business last year, $25 million over the last 3 years. Their bills are paid. It doesn't happen that often. It happens mostly in a contracting economic environment. The same thing as it happens to all small business people. And Alaska is full of it. You look at the bankruptcies. It's not only subcontractors, suppliers. It is everybody. Everybody is affected by the economy. That's what we're dealing with here. This bill doesn't absolutely guarantee payment to anybody. So I do not believe, number one, is that everything was so good and going into 82, 83, 84, 85. These people did not use their notices of right to lien. They did not use the mechanics of the bill, even though, and I will admit that the bill itself is confusing. It is not written properly, and there is some confusing facets to the bill itself. The position as to priority has nothing to do with that. The position relative to how it's used, I do not believe, in my opinion, until just recently, by the way, have we seen some use, because they've gone out there after they've done several million dollars worth of business with a particular builder, and all of a sudden, because of economic conditions, he's in trouble, they start to use it. And they've stopped waiving it, because those rights were waived to a lot of builders on many occasions. And I think everybody in this room that is a supplier or a subcontractor would tell you they do not use it universally. That becomes the problem, because they don't. They make and pick and choose who they're going to use it with. In many cases, their losses as a result of not using it in all cases. Notice is another thing. There's a multitude of things and a very complex issue that affects this overall thing.
Representative Pierce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Club is a mutual bank. Who actually regulates Alaska Mutual Bank?
We are not a mutual bank. We are a full-service bank. We are regulated by FDIC.
And the state?
And the state.
And I assume that when the state and FDIC examiners come in, they look closely at your lending.
That's correct.
Okay. Presently, what does your bank do as far as if I come in and want a construction loan on a project, what percentage of the value of the as-built value of the project will you lend, and how do you determine that percentage?
The standard industry practice is approximately 80% of the proposed value.
And
at a point in time. Pardon me.
How do you come up?
It's done
by
a third party appraisal.
One
third party appraisal. That's correct.
Okay, so you're lending 80% on what the appraisal value should be down the road. Is that the same whether I'm a small home builder or am going out to build a new office building?
No.
Okay. What do you do for the
There's two types of
construction? Pardon me. What do you do for the commercial construction loans?
value in commercial construction has a relative, it has a relationship to the income stream. And the value is very complex, and as far as the lending side of it, and it's determined by a variety of factors.
Well, if I come in and want to build a commercial building, how are you going to decide what percentage of whatever value we come to an agreement on you're going to own? Is it still going to be 80%?
No.
What's the standard?
Typically, at the present time, given the income stream of a commercial office building or whatever, it's approximately 70% of value.
Okay. When you do have to foreclose, the loss that, and if and when the bank loses money, if you've only lent 80% against what the future loss or the future value is going to be, and if you're only letting the money go out the door as things are completed, then what causes the losses that you do have?
Okay, well, number one is, I think, recognizing what is value in a project on a proposed basis and what is in reality. From this point in time, you start something until this point in time is complete, can be two different things. You can have a complete change in market conditions. If you look basically within the last year, I would say there has been an average reduction in values of about $8,000. If you started something here, it's gone backwards $8,000. You're forgetting the fact that basically 6% of that value, original as proposed value, is it relates to sales costs, as it relates to builder's overhead, as it relates to a variety of factors. And typically, there are other problems, usually incomplete by the time that we get to that point in time.
I'm not forgetting. I'm trying to get it on the record.
Okay. So there's a variety of factors that when you get to this point where the decision is made to foreclose in a contracted marketplace and so forth and so on, you foreclose, we still have the sales costs, and a variety of other costs from the standpoint of legal costs to foreclose. During the course of foreclosure, we have to inspect once a week. We have to make sure that we don't freeze up. We transfer all utilities into the bank's name and a variety of other things. All those are costs. Not taking into account opportunity costs as it relates to dollars. You're forgetting, once again, is those dollars are real money dollars that we have in the project that we are receiving nothing from, so forth and so on. We do, in fact, have losses associated with foreclosures.
My name's not on the bill. I'm just asking you questions. All right. Do you consider banking in Alaska to be competitive? In other words, does Alaska Mutual Bank want to go out and make loans to home builders at a rate which will meet or exceed the other banks?
Alaska Mutual is the leader in the construction field as it relates to building. Alaska Mutual's position may drastically change given the passage of this bill.
Okay. Would you expect to see Alaska Mutual Bank lower the limit of the amount of money you would lend if this bill passes?
I would suggest if we lowered and required actual cash equity and so forth and so on in these projects and that type of thing, that you will probably see a lot fewer builders.
Well, I know that, but I'm saying would you go to 70% rather than 80%?
We very well may.
Okay. Is there any regulation that you presently have from the state that you see this affecting? In other words, when our bank examiners come in, are they probably going to tell you as a result of this that you've got to do something more than you're already doing?
I would suggest they would tell us to contract a construction lender.
All right. And on the question of who assumes the risk, as I see it, when I put my money in a bank, and the bank lends the money, then the risk is mine as much as it is the bank's. But I think Representative Cotton led Mr. Jones through a description of, or I guess it was Representative Phillips, who assumes the risk? Is it the builder and the bank? Who is it? And I guess I'd like on the record your comment as to who you think is assuming that perhaps the first risk.
My opinion in that regard is this. In this whole process and the conversations I've listened to today, to the way I see it, everybody has forgotten the one important ingredient in this thing. I've heard about subcontractors building houses and suppliers, materials. The builder himself, the person borrowing the money, has borrowed money with a promise to repay and in turn pay for his materials and subcontractors. That's the agreement going in. We as a lender hopefully have done our due diligence relative to making sure this man has a good credit history, that this person has the ability to go out there and perform in a timely fashion. We do those things. He goes out, and at that stage of the game, can have problems. As same as any business person can have problems. It can be market problems, it could be excavation problems. There's all kinds of things in the course of construction, and it's a complex issue from a standpoint of starting, digging a hole in the ground and building a house. There's a lot of components that go to it and so forth, but that builder is the risk aspect of it. We, the lender, provide the dollars. And in turn, I'd love to see criminal penalties associated with misappropriation. In our case, I can assure you that doesn't happen very often. It has happened, and I will admit it, it's happened. But we're going to change the entire thing for nominal, and it is nominal, problems relative to the total. And everybody in the case of foreclosure, and I will say everybody, loses. To the degree of the loss, I can't tell you that. Anybody that makes a decision from the standpoint of a small contractor, that he's made a decision to be a businessman. He's made a decision to be a businessman and go out there and work for himself. He takes risks. It's the same as we all take risks. If I do a lousy job lending money, I'm not going to be there tomorrow. That's the risk. If he goes out there and makes a bad decision as it relates to who he's going to do work for, he has to pay the penalties. The same as all of us do. And I have a real problem with legislating absolutes, absolute payment, and so forth and so on.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Cotton.
Well, of course, it already has been legislated.
Not absolutes.
Well, no, that's true. Absolutes aren't there, but you absolutely are, as a bank, in a better position than someone who isn't. But that's fine. I really learned a lot from what you had to say, and I appreciate that. And I guess I understood you to say that you felt that criminal penalties may be a deterrent to people who don't pay their bills.
I agree.
I mean, right now, obviously, a person that doesn't pay their bills is open for civil claim. And